Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show with hosts Phil Huff and Julie Calamine.
Good morning, Phil, and welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a couple weeks.
Yes, it has, and I understand you've been away vacationing.
Oh, we had a wonderful time. We went down to Nevada. We left in summer, and we came back in fall, late fall, early winter, something. Transition in 2 weeks here was amazing, but where we were, too, it was the same. We entered the Ruby Mountains in summer, short sleeves, and we exited Ely in a snowstorm.
I can imagine. Yes, and it's been the same here, but it sounds like we're going to be having some warmer weather before it really stays cold.
Yeah, I hope so. Let's take a look at the weather while we're talking about that. Today is going to be a high of 69, mostly sunny. Tonight, mostly clear with a low of 45. So we are getting into those autumn temperatures. Tomorrow, it warms back up to near summer, Indian summer maybe, 73 degrees with a low of 47. Clear Wednesday night, Thursday night, more of the same temperature-wise. Thursday, mid-70s in the day, mid-40s at night. Then we slide into the weekend, and it's showing a chance of showers.
Well, we could still use some more showers, and I know that because I was hopeful about a fall mushroom season. I've been out mushrooming a bit and not seen anything. I think we need a little warmer temps and maybe just a little more moisture.
Yeah, and the rain will do some good for the turtles.
That is true, which brings us to our guest this morning, a very interesting guest. This morning we're being joined by a PhD graduate student whose name is Jennifer Pruitt. She's a grad student at Auburn University, but she's all the way up here in the Idaho Panhandle for an interesting study. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. It's really good to be here.
Thank you. And do you go by Jennifer or by Jenna?
Jenna.
Okay, we'll make note.
Welcome to the show, Jenna.
Thank you.
All right. And there's just a lot of questions Phil and I have. We've been talking about this before you joined us, but why don't you start by telling us a bit about yourself, how you came to be at Auburn, and how you then came to be here at in Sandpoint.
Sure. Well, I grew up in rural South Carolina, so sort of the middle of nowhere. I think a town that's smaller than Sandpoint, actually, so about 3,500 people. Oddly enough, the UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, is from there, so Bamberg, South Carolina. And then I decided to go to Clemson University, which is one of the two sort of larger universities in South Carolina, but they have a really great research program, really great faculty, and I had some great professors along the way that led me into research. I did research there under Dr. Rick Bloeb. It was biomechanics of turtles, so a little bit different, and then that sort of led me to Auburn, where I am in my second year studying ecology, physiology, and mainly nesting ecology of turtles right now.
So how did you come to focus in even early on turtles?
So it just sort of happened, actually. It was sort of a random series of events that led me there. I took a class with Dr. Bloeb. I found him to be a really sort of inspiring professor, and then I had asked him if I could work in his lab just to get some experience, and it led me to turtles, which I ended up really loving.
Turtles are rather lovable.
Who doesn't? I agree.
Except maybe the snapping turtles. They're not so lovable.
Lovely on a menu and underneath the heading of soup.
Oh, there no.
Oh, dear. Phil. So you told us how you ended up at Auburn, and you're pursuing a PhD, I understand.
That's right. Yeah, I just switched into a PhD degree recently.
And what will be your terminal degree?
So I have a PhD in biology, and then with a focus probably on nesting ecology. I'll narrow that down a little bit more as I go through my degree and finish up some projects.
All right.
So you're up here in the Panhandle for a specific study project. Give us an overview of that.
Right. So my advisor has been working at Round Lake State Park for about 5 years now. And this is part of a broader study, which we could probably talk about a little bit later. But it's studying sort of the nesting ecology of the Western painted turtle. And so some of the things that we want to find out is how many times a year they're nesting, how many eggs they're laying. We also want to know where they're choosing to lay their eggs, if they're choosing to lay them in a certain spot. So those are some of the questions that we're addressing. And then some of the questions that I am interested in are how those choices in nest site would affect the outcome for the hatchlings. So whether that affects their fitness, whether it affects their survival, are some of the questions I'm interested in.
So it sounds like from just the way you phrased it all that not that much is really known about the reproductive cycle of the painted turtle.
That's right. And so turtles pose, they're a really interesting system for this type of question. It's a lot easier to study shorter-lived animals when it comes to reproduction because they live for, you know, 1 to 2 years, and you get to study multiple reproductive cycles. But with these, they could live up to 35 years, sometimes 40, 50 years. And so it's really hard to track them along and along. So it makes them a little bit more interesting to study for reproduction.
How can you tell the age of a turtle? Are you counting, you're not counting tree rings. Are you counting wrinkles or things on the shell?
It's very similar to tree rings. So you can tell with sort of wrinkles in the carapace, which is the domed part of the shell.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Their shells grow over the years.
They do. And it can be difficult to age a turtle because the shells will wear down from water. Sometimes they'll get rubbed on things, but that's one way to tell.
Your advisor, Dr. Dan Warner, is in Auburn. And how did he come to find a study site in the Idaho Panhandle?
Right. So that gets into sort of the broader study that this is a part of. Dr. Warner, who my advisor at Auburn, is a part of an NSF grant that was written to study how nesting behavior varies across geographic areas. So there are sites similar to this all across the country, in southern areas like New Mexico, all the way over to Iowa, Illinois, one in Portland, and then we have one here. And so he kind of ended up here and I ended up here. Just because this site is really incredible to work at.
Now, the broader study, is it all painted turtles or are there other turtles involved?
Right. So it is all painted turtles. And that's one interesting thing about painted turtles that makes them really great for this study is they have a huge geographic distribution. So they're all across the country, some up into Canada, down to the east. So they're all over the place, which makes them good for these geographic studies to see how differing climates might affect nesting behavior.
Yeah, from what little research I was able to do before the show, the most widespread turtle species in North America?
That is correct.
Yep. Yeah, and maybe the most numerous too, is that true?
Not necessarily numerous. The distribution is widespread. I'm not positive that translate to the most numerous, but some other species have, you know, larger clutch sizes and things like that that could contribute to that.
Well, let's move on to the actual study you're doing. And I have to introduce this portion by saying that I met Jenna at Round Lake State Park. My husband Daniel and I were taking our usual hike with our little dog, and we had friends from Minnesota visiting, and it was a very mosquito-y, wet mosquito.
I remember.
We were practically running out of the park. But as we were doing that, we noticed a young woman digging along the side of the trail, and it forced us to stop our sprint away from the mosquitoes to ask what she was up to. And that was how I met you. Tell us about the cycle of the study, because you were here earlier in the summer and now you're here again.
Right. So I spent about 6 weeks here this summer, and sort of I'll get into the study first. What I wanted to learn coming into this experiment was how very specific factors in nest site choice affect survival and fitness across life stages in painted turtles. So what I was testing specifically was how distance to water, so how far away they are from the water, which is where they have to disperse to. I wanted to see how that would affect the hatchlings, as well as when those hatchlings disperse out of their nests to water. And I also wanted to know how shade cover affects development. So how I sort of cross-fostered these eggs around in nests to have different levels of shade and distance to water, so that I could get to how those two factors were affecting survival of the hatchlings as well as their ability to disperse. Hmm. And so I was here for 6 weeks this summer. We camp at the park. The staff at the park is incredibly helpful. They have been for 5 years now. But we camp at the park for 6 weeks. We walk the trails, and we have sort of discrete locations where we commonly see the turtles nesting. And we'll walk the trails. You look for a shiny thing that looks like a rock. and that's probably a mother up to nest, and then we'll just kind of sit there and wait for them to nest, and then we can take measurements on their eggs and things like that. So
you had a very specific focus for your study this summer, but the study at Round Lake even has been going on for some number of years. Give us a little broader background on that and how your focus dovetailed into what's been going on.
Right. So, the study at Round Lake has been going on for a while, and it will continue to go on. And, you know, we've been collecting a lot of data, so knowing how many eggs each mother's laying each time she comes up. We mark the females when they come up, so that now we've reached a point where most all the females we encounter are marked. So we have, you know, 5 years worth of data on all of these females. They don't come up to nest every year necessarily, or we don't find them every year, but we do have data on them spanning across a large period of time. So with all of that, we're able to kind of study how their nesting behavior may change over time, or how their nesting behavior is here as opposed to other locations.
And how did a professor from Auburn and a grad student or students from Auburn come to choose a small spot in North Idaho?
Right. Yeah, it's kind of strange. And I always get this question because Alabama is a bit of a turtle hotspot. We have 31 species of turtles in Alabama. But I'm traveling all the way across the country to study turtles in Idaho. And I think that's just because, you know, this Idaho site was a part of a broader study, but it is just so beautiful here and so pristine, I think is the word that I would use, unspoiled. And we have incredible survival here, really good numbers, really good sample size. And then the staff makes it so easy for us to come here and to work. So I can't give enough shout outs to the Round Lake staff.
And who wouldn't want to come to Northern Panhandle of Idaho in the middle of a hot Alabama summer?
Sure. I agree.
Now, are you coming back this December?
I don't have to come back in December, thankfully, because I don't think that my Southern blood could take the cold. I don't think I could handle it.
Now, Gonzaga University is involved in the study as well. Tell us a little bit about that partnership.
That's right. So like a lot of collaborations, this is sort of a just kind of weird connections that happen randomly. But my advisor, Dr. Warner, and Dr. Elizabeth Addis, who's at Gonzaga University now, they were postdocs together at Iowa State University. They had different advisors at the time, but they shared an office space. And that sort of just led them to working together now. And then, of course, Gonzaga is about an hour away, so it works out really well for us logistically to be working together.
And does Dr. Addis make it out to the Round Lake site?
She does. So previous to this past summer, Dr. Addis has been, she hasn't come out quite as often, but this summer we were out there all, me, Dr. Addis, two undergrads, Megan Sadoff, and then Spencer Roop were all out there working on the site together.
I have to back up a little bit. You mentioned that you've been studying the number of eggs that Western painted turtles might lay annually. How many is it?
So usually a clutch, which is just what you call the amount of eggs that they lay, a clutch can range on average between 12 and 15. That's a pretty common thing to see. And then we've also noticed that quite often they'll lay two clutches per season.
Is that unique for among turtles?
Not really unique among turtles. They, you know, this, a lot of them will share sort of a similar nesting ecology, but there are quite a few different reproductive patterns among turtles.
So tell us about that season and about that pattern, because from what I know, it's fairly unusual.
Right. So painted turtles have a really sort of strange life history, which makes them really interesting for me to study. When a mother comes up, she lays eggs, she'll cover those up, and then she leaves them. And so that's sort of how the mothers, their nesting ecology. And then those eggs will stay in the nest until now, which is when we come back to check up on them, and that's when they've hatched. So they're hatching in September roundabout. But then the really interesting thing is that the turtles will then stay in their nest through the winter. So they don't dig out as soon as they've hatched. It's almost like a hibernation period at the beginning of their lives. So they'll stay in their nests until April, May, about, and then that's when they'll disperse.
So they're almost more like bears that will give birth in the den, and there's some prenatal or postnatal growth in the den, rather than we think of giving birth in the springtime for most animals.
Right, yeah. So it's really a strange time for them to give birth, because then these turtles have to kind of hang out underground and hunker down for the winter.
And that's not typical for most turtles.
Right, right, yes. Right.
So how do is the mother and or father care for them in the nest over the winter, or are they on their own?
So there's no maternal care, no paternal care. They just lay the eggs and leave them. But that is sort of the question that I'm addressing. So they don't have maternal care after they've hatched. But is there a maternal care, kind of in quotes, before the eggs are laid? So are the moms choosing really good sites for their eggs to develop?
So the ultimate latchkey kids, does mom leave some food for them behind?
No, well, she leaves yolk. So they do have yolk to get them through to now. Some of them will retain yolk on their belly that'll get them through the winter. But other than that, they really just kind of slow down their metabolism and just hunker down until the summer.
They just hang out.
And then when they get out, they must be really, really hungry. How do they know what to find for food?
So as soon as they're digging out, they will go to the water. So that's kind of an instinctual thing. And then, again, instinctual, just them being able to find some food, probably really small food at that point, because they're no bigger than, you know, a quarter at that point.
What are small turtles foods? Are they vegetables? Are they little bugs? What are they eating when they come out?
They're not really specialty eaters, so they're not very picky, unlike me, but they do like to eat quite a variety of things that they will usually be finding in the water. So it could be insects, could be some vegetation, things like that.
So are their nests well secured from predators? How do they, it seems like they'd be very vulnerable to predation through a winter when a lot of potential predators would be very hungry.
Yeah, it does seem like they would be quite vulnerable. And I think there have been studies in the past that have shown that predators are pretty good at sniffing them out. Fortunately, at this site, and this is another reason that we've chosen to study them here, we have very low predation rates. So there are some rodents that may sniff them out, but other than that, we don't experience much predation here, whereas other sites in this study will have really high predation rates. So they can be sniffed out, but actually, whenever we try to sniff them out, whenever we see a mom nesting for the study, it can be quite difficult. So there was actually a nest this past year, and this happens just about every year. We saw the mom nesting, we knew about where she was, and then when we went to dig it up, couldn't find it at all. Mm. They pack it down really well.
Hmm, that's interesting.
So they are buried. That gives them some level of obscurity.
Yeah, they bury them, and you can see they do a little bit of a dance where they wiggle back and forth, and that packs down the soil. And then they also, when they come up to nest, they fill their bladders with pond water, and they'll release that on there, so it gives another compaction of the soil.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. And what would the typical predator be for a young painted turtle, other than the rodents you've mentioned?
So here I would say probably rodents, maybe the odd raccoon. We do, in this study, put a wire mesh over the top of the nests. That has sort of a double purpose in protecting from predators, but also helping us to find the nests again. So we've put a lot of work into finding these really hidden nests, and then we put the protectors over. But the rodents burrow underground, so that poses a sort of different problem.
So the natural predators, rodents, raccoons, do local dogs and cats ever disturb them?
I feel like that would be a problem in more of an urban area, which, you know, in areas like Portland where we have a site, that becomes a problem. But we haven't had a problem here with dogs disturbing them at all.
So tell us about some of the other locations in the broader study, to give a range of the spectrum of the study.
So there's one in New Mexico, and this is the only site that I've ever been to personally, but I've heard tales of the other sites from the other people who are parts of the study. And one of the really interesting ones is Turtle Camp in Iowa. So it's called Turtle Camp, and there are just a massive number of nesters there. And it can get quite busy. I've heard the postdoc in our lab, who has kind of done the research that's led to my research questions told me a story one time that there were so many turtles nesting that he had to ride a bicycle back and forth to check on the status of the females. So it's kind of busy in that area.
And was that area another site for painted turtles, or was that additional species?
That was another painted turtle site.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're all the way over in Iowa.
Interesting. Well, Minnesota is full of painted turtles, and I have to share a short story about my husband once again. He's a turtle saver. If he sees a turtle on the roadside, he's got a screech pull over, and he wants to make sure that the turtle gets across the road. Is that a common reaction for people when they see a turtle on the road?
It's a common reaction for me, so I'm also obviously a turtle saver. I've slammed on brakes a number of times. But actually, and sadly, at my undergrad university, they did a study with decoys to see what reaction people had to turtles being in the road. And what the study found was that people, more often than not, will actually swerve to hit a turtle rather than swerving to miss a turtle or stopping to put it out of the road, which is pretty sad. But the lesson to be learned from that is if you see a turtle in the road and you can safely pull over, and that's kind of a key. You want to make sure you're safe as well. But pull over, see which direction they're facing, and sort of help them across the road that way.
So it leads us to the age-old question, why does the turtle cross the road?
If I had to guess, a turtle crossing the road here is probably going to nest, actually. They don't like to move around a lot. They're kind of slow, you know, as it goes. But going to nest, going to find food, that's what my guess would be.
What is their typical range of a turtle? How far from their nest do they roam?
Turtles tend to be homebodies. Well, I'll say terrestrial and aquatic turtles, freshwater turtles. Because, as you know, sea turtles can roam around quite a bit, many hundreds of miles. But these guys tend to stay put in the same area, which is good for our study because we can get repeated nesters year after year. The same females coming back up again.
And they tend to be more solo. I think of turtles walking by an urban or semi-urban pond or a place like Round Lake, and you see a bunch of them out on a log hanging out together. Do they hang out in groups, or are they more solo?
They will hang out in groups, and I think that's probably a product of this is a really good spot to get some sunlight during the day. So they know where the best spots are, and so you'll tend to see these big aggregations of turtles getting sort of good resources.
And so for a group, it's a flock of seagulls, a murder of crows. What's a group of turtles?
Oh, man.
Herd, a pack, a flock?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'll have to look that one up later.
Let's find that out on the music break here.
Yes. You mentioned that some of the reasons that the turtle might be crossing the road would be for nesting, but I noticed them in the fall, too. Are they looking for spots to hibernate? What do you think it might be?
So, you know, in the fall, it's going to be a little bit chillier. And so probably looking for good basking spots, looking for food again, those are probably good motivations for them to be moving around, especially when it's cooler.
Hmm. And you mentioned that they might lay eggs more than once per year. I assume that's in the spring. But then when would the next nesting happen? Also in the spring?
So this summer we had about 7 repeated nesters. So usually it'll happen. Their first nest will be at the end of May, beginning of June. And then their second nest will be at the end of June. So they have a pretty quick turnaround on their nesting.
Unlike like game birds that'll have a nest early and then one midsummer. They just run right back up and repeat.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I see. What have you found interesting about the study?
So it's been sort of interesting to me, and it kind of blows my mind still, even though I've been reading literature on this for a while, that the moms are they're so particular about where they want to nest. And you'll see this if you ever watch a female turtle nest, it can take several hours. So it can take them hours to find the spot. I remember watching a turtle this summer, and she walked around in a circle with a radius of about 2 feet for 2 hours, trying to decide where the best spot to lay a nest was. And so you can see them really kind of picking and choosing the right areas. They'll put their chins down on the ground, maybe to help them sense temperatures and things like that. But they really take care in picking a spot, and then they really take care in actually digging and covering the nests. So it's really interesting to see that type of care put into laying the eggs, even though they don't have care in the traditional sense.
Mm-hmm. A little bit like a bird selecting its nesting spot, and then they are so careful in creating their nests.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And this morning, we're talking about turtles with Jenna Pruitt, a graduate student, postgraduate student from University of Auburn, who's been up here the last, how long, a couple summers?
I've been here for two summers.
Two summers, doing a study at Round Lake in partnership with University of Gonzaga. We're going to take a short music break here, and then we'll be back and talk more about turtles. We are going to listen to the turtles, Happy Together, and the song should be familiar to most. They were a short-lived band in the late 60s. This was their second biggest but best-known hit. The Turtles, Happy Together. And who wouldn't be happy, buried underground, left to starve for the winter? But,
turtle babies, so, they would be.
So, according to one of our avid listeners and the Oxford Dictionary, a group of turtles is called a bale or a tern of turtles.
T-U-R-N.
T-U-R-N, not a bird, T-E-R-N, but a tern. A bale or tern.
I'm learning stuff today, too.
That's right. Maybe turtles turn more than we know.
So where we last picked up, we were talking about the twice-a-year reproductive cycle, and I'm curious to hear more about what the success rate, how many eggs do they lay, and what's the survival rate of that like?
And about this year in particular, because we had a very wet spring and then a dry, dry summer.
Right. So another reason, I keep coming back to this, another reason we really like this site is because there's usually very high survival rates, so usually about 95% survival, which is really good for us. But this year, unfortunately, we had a really dry summer. And whenever something lays eggs, moisture becomes extremely important for the eggs to develop. And so this summer, because it was so dry, we had a pretty low survival rate through the summer. So that was because the eggs weren't able to sort of keep up with their moisture demands throughout the summer.
So the initial survival rate, generally high, the summer a little low. What are the long-term prospects? When does the turtle that's emerged from the shell begin to mature enough and enter its own reproductive life cycle?
It seems kind of sad at the time whenever you have really low survival, but it's important to remember for population stability that a mom and a male and a female turtle, whenever they produce offspring, they just need to replace themselves to keep a population stable. And, you know, these female turtles may lay about 1,000 eggs over their lifetime. So it looks bad now, but it's okay for the population long term to survive and to thrive, actually. But these guys have probably about a 5-year period before they reach, 5 to 7 years before they reach reproductive maturity, and they start laying eggs themselves.
A lot can happen in those 5 years.
That's right. Lots of adventures for the teenage turtles.
How does the young teenage turtle find its partner? How can you identify the gender of a turtle?
So it's actually, you have to get kind of intimate with the turtles, but you have to look at their cloacas, the word, sort of like a generalized
opening. Can we say that on the radio, Julie?
Cloaca, yes. It refers to chickens too, I believe.
Okay.
Yes. Anything, reptiles, and birds are reptiles. So, yeah.
Well, we won't do that at home then. We won't try to, determine the sex of our turtles. But during the break, you mentioned something interesting about turtles and how they come to be male or female.
That's right. So these guys are really interesting. And this is another thing that makes them good for ecological studies, especially with nesting, is that they have something called temperature-dependent sex determination. And this is found in a lot of different reptiles, some fish, some most all turtles. So this is a model where the temperature completely determines the sex of the offspring. And in this species, it has three different main types. But in this species, it's hot chicks and cool dudes. So hot temperatures produce females and cool temperatures produce males.
And what's the third type?
So that type is hot produces females, cold produces males. And then there's another type where you know, one type is produced at the medians, one is produced at the extremes.
So that happens before they emerge from the shell. It's not like a transgender thing afterwards. They can change the sex of themselves.
Right. So it's it happens in the second third of development. Ah. So after the first third is finished, that's when sex determined.
And the implications of the study, are they leading you toward any conclusions about the turtles and climate change, et cetera? Where are we going with the boys and girls and the temps, all that?
Right. So one huge concern is with shifting climates as they shift now, is that we might see skews in sex ratios. So hot chicks, if we have warming of the climate, that could lead to a skewed female population. And so that's kind of a concern whenever it comes to population dynamics. If we have very few males, these females won't have mates in, you know, 5 to 7 years when they reach maturity. And so one sort of interesting thing that we've found with this study, as well as studies in other areas, is that the females are able to adjust their nesting behavior to sort of mediate that change in climate. So in warmer areas, they will actually choose cooler spots, and in cooler areas, they choose warmer spots so that you get a more balanced sex ratio.
And so that finding implies that the study has been going on for some time. Let's talk a little bit about how long it's been going on and how long it's going to go on. Is there an end in sight?
Right. So we are pretty much at the end of this grant. And so the National Science Foundation has given funds for us to do this research. So we are probably, we're looking at the data now. And so we wanted sort of this long-term study, looking at how they're behaving, looking at how they're nesting. And so what that's going to give us is hopefully the ability to build a model. So models are really, really helpful in science. They help us sort of make predictions about the future and what future behavior might look like. So that's what we're hoping to get out of the data that we have now.
And do you consider 5 years a long-term study?
It's not quite that long in relative to the lifespan of a turtle. But for the precedent that's been set, it is quite long. So there's nothing quite this long, a long-term right now. So it is compared to what we have so far.
And so it sounds like it's going to wrap up this summer, next summer?
For this purpose, it will be wrapping up, but Dr. Addis is going to continue work at Round Lake. So she's going to be continuing to get this data about where they're nesting, the temperatures of where they're nesting, shade cover, things like that. We'll keep learning about it, keep collecting data that'll hopefully contribute.
Is there a role for or need for help from citizen scientists, volunteers?
So we really appreciate being able to tell people about this research. So that's kind of the main thing we want from people, is to listen about what we're learning. And we really, you know, we do these studies to learn things and then to distribute that information to people. So it's really nice to be able to just communicate with people about it and have them interested in it.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit complex. When I was there, I noticed that Jenna was actually removing eggs and carefully transporting them. So I can imagine you need rather specialized training to conduct this study.
So speaking of the results, when will when will the paper be ready, or the papers be ready?
So as soon as I get back, actually, I'm going to start compiling data to look at this site specifically. So that'll be sort of my job, is looking at the nesting behavior here, how it may have stayed the same or changed over this five-year period, and just kind of delving into the data, looking at some of the questions that we can answer using the data.
And will this be the subject for your doctoral dissertation?
So this will be part of it. This will probably be a chapter in my dissertation. And then I will probably move forward with a different study organism. So most people in my lab actually study brown anoles. They're a lizard species, actually. So they're invasive to Florida, which makes them really easy to study. And so that's probably where I'll go moving forward. Similar questions, just a different system.
So you're moving away from turtles.
I don't know that I'll ever be able to completely move away. I may do some side projects and work with turtles because they do have a special place in my heart.
So when you finish up, will those results be available online somewhere at the Round Lake State Parks website, or Gonzaga, or Auburn's, or your own?
Yes, so we'll do our best to keep Round Lake updated with the information that we're getting. But our lab website is always a good place to look for information coming out of the lab. It's a good place to look for my contact information.
Okay, and how would we find that?
You could just search Warner Lab Auburn in Google. That would probably be the easiest way to find it. And you will find me on there as well as other people in the lab.
And we were looking at one of the breaks at some photos. Do you have those available for the public to view?
Yes. So the easiest place to find the photos would probably be on my Twitter account. And I'll make sure that a link to that is on our lab website. I'll text somebody as soon as we finish up the show. But if you want to look directly on Twitter, my handle is turtles are cool too. So it's spelled like turtles, the letter R, cool, and then another number two.
And if you're a fan of any kind of baby animals, these are darling babies. So take a look.
We're running a little short on time. Is there anything we've missed you want to tell us about? Any interesting or fun stories from the last couple of years of study?
You know, it's really a blast to work out here, and I've gotten to do it with so many different people. The NSF has been really helpful. Again, like I said, they funded this project, but we've had a lot of graduate students, undergraduate students, and different people who have supported this project. But it's so fun. You know, you're camping out there for 6 weeks, up watching turtles nest until 1 or 2 in the morning. So it's a really great experience to work out here.
Nightlife.
That's right.
Exactly.
And you mentioned the important role of education in your study, and I would like to thank you for having taken the time that you took to spend with my family and my friends to tell us all about this study. It's fascinating.
Well, it's been really great to be on and talk to you guys about it.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the show, Jenna. And if you've tuned in late and missed any of the show, or would simply like to listen to it again, you can always listen to our podcast. It'll be available online later today at www.krfy.org. And of course, if you're a fan of The Morning Show, you can listen to us each and every week live at 88.5 or live streaming at KRFY or again, any of the back podcasts. Thank you for coming in today, Jenna.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to listen right now. The Calm and the Crying Wind by Trampled, not Painted by Turtles. It's Painted Turtles we listened to today. This was by Trampled Turtles.
We are so fascinated by the Painted Turtles study, we can't get it out of our minds.
Really quite amazing. So a lot of good morning shows coming up. If you are a fan of The Morning Show, join us Wednesday mornings. Tomorrow morning will be Chris Bessler and Susie Perez. Their guests will be Crosstoberfest organizers and Team Autism representatives, Charles Mortensen and Wayne Pinolet.
And before you go on to Thursday, Phil, I'd like to remind everyone that if they enjoy easy listening music in the morning, you can listen to Bernie Mosier with his music show before that from, I believe it's 5 to 7 every morning now.
Every morning or every Wednesday?
Every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday morning, 5
yes,
to 7.
Yes, pardon me. It's great, though. You should all tune in if you're up.
Yeah, it's one of our really, really great new shows. Thursday morning, you can join hosts Jack Peterson and Jim Healy. Their guests will be Hannah Combs, Art Administrator for the Pondere Arts Council. That's at 8 a.m. on 88.5 KRFY. And coming up next Tuesday, I'll be gone again, Julie. I'm sorry to say it's my busy travel schedule. We're going to Arkansas for a Wilderness Stewardship Conference.
Neat. We will miss you, Phil.
Yeah, and I'm going to miss the show next week. It's a frequent guest, Matt Haig from Idaho Fish and Game with a fall update. Probably be talking about the hunting season and what else is happening.
Yes, how to be safe, what's happening, what the upcoming seasons are looking like for the animals that we go out looking for.
We've got a few more things coming up with the station. Julie, why don't you tell us about it?
Well, yes, I do. First of all, I'd like to mention that we have an online auction coming up, and that's October 14th through 22nd. That's a few weeks out, but I just wanted to give a shout out to some of the folks who've been donating, and those of you listening, if you have an idea for an online auction donation, think about that and get in touch with me. I'll be able to make sure you get online, but I want to shout out to Pondere Garden Center, Baxter's, Red Wheelbarrow Gardens, and also to Marilyn McEnroe, who's donating a painting for us. McIntyre.
And KRFY is listener-supported community radio, and community radio stations, like so many volunteer things in Sandpoint and in our area, exist only because of individuals who support us, individual underwriters, organizations and businesses who underwrite us, folks who donate things for online auctions, and of course, really importantly, our member listeners, those who sign up and those who bid on the auction. So this is a really easy way to support community radio and get something back, the silent online auction.
That's right. And next week, I'll mention a few other contributors. Beyond that, for those of you who like to get out and stretch your legs as your way of helping out community radio, you can join me on October 8th because I'm doing my fall Adopt Highway cleanup. And it's a really fun one, guys. It's going to have cleanup, but beyond that, we'll have a social hour following. We'll also have a prize for the very best piece of garbage collected. That'll be on the 8th from 1 to 3 p.m.
And you can come out and see some of the other, meet some of the other folks who are listeners of and supporters of community radio.
Yes, and do a good thing for the highway. It gets messy out there, folks.
It does. This is the time of year to clean it up before the snow falls.
That's right.
Lots of things happening as we wind down the end of September. On the 27th, that's tomorrow night, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a kokanee spawning presentation put on by the Pendre chapter of the Idaho Master Naturalists. Mm-hmm. They're sponsoring it at 12 noon in the Avista Day Use Area at Trestle Creek. Fisheries Regional Manager Andy Ducks will give a presentation on the kokanee that are spawning right now. It's a great time to see them. If you haven't been out and seen the redback kokanee spawning up any of the creeks, it's a wonderful fall activity.
And that's an easy spot to reach. It's just on your way out to Hope or Clark Fork.
Trestle Creek Road, the day use area is on the right, not far from Highway 200. So free and open to the public. If you want more information, you can call 208-610-6784. And we're winding down the season of Yappy Hours, but there is yet another Yappy Hour on the 28th. I'm sure you and Dexter will be going to that, won't you, Julie?
Most likely.
It's a tail wagging good time for people and pooches alike. Bring your dog and enjoy a Panhandle Animal Shelter benefit with live music, food and beverages available for purchase, plus a fenced-in area for the dogs, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Eichert's Pub and Grill. This is the last Thursday of the month. I think, is there one more in October?
I'm not sure, but you know, it's a great way to support the shelter, and it's fun.
And it's hard to believe, but we are rolling into October this weekend with a week-long October celebration, Oktoberfest celebration at McDuff's Beer Hall, 220 Cedar. They're hosting this with lots of great events. There's information on a Devin Wade release party, Oktoberfest on Saturday, and the Boobs and Beer Garden on Sunday, which is part of the Boobs and Beer Run, a fundraiser put on by the 7B Women Group. This is the second annual Boobs and Beer Fun Run 5K. It's sponsored by the 7B Women, the offshoot now of the Sandpoint Chamber of Commerce, 11 a.m. on Sunday, October 1st. I think you can still pre-register. There is information at 7bwomen.com.
And you don't have to be a woman to sign up, by the way.
No, you don't. In fact, I went last year, and I say the event attracted a lot of men.
I can just imagine.
Yeah. So it's a great event. Support the community. Also, this weekend is National Public Lands Day, the last Saturday of each month, and that's the 30th, is National Public Lands Day. The Friends of Scotchman Peaks will be hosting a trail work day on Morris and Regal Creek. It's an annual event with a picnic to follow. They might even do a little bit more brushing work on those trails than in years past. If there's a good crowd, there's something for everybody. Pull a Pulaski, bring a lopper. But volunteer. You can get more information by emailing sandy@scotchmanpeaks.org.
And it's really true that it's just about what you are able to do and would wish to do. Mm-hmm. So don't feel like you shouldn't sign up if you're not like the most physically working out person.
But you would need to be physically fit for the Sandpoint Cyclocross. I would not recommend doing that one. That's the 30th and the 1st, the Crosstoberfest. They're hosting that again at the University of Idaho Extension Office at 2510 North Boyer, which may not be the U of I property in the near future. I know that's up for sale. So if you want a chance to experience the Crosstoberfest race course, the first race is at 9 a.m. that Saturday, the last race at 2:45 p.m. each day. It's a unique form of bike racing. Racers ride over dirt, gravel, sand, water, hills, and dales, much like running a steeplechase race. It's super fun and great for the spectators. So it is open to the public. There'll be food from Jupiter Jane available, and the event benefits Team Autism 24/7. So if you want more information on that, you can go to wildwestcxseries.com. Also on Saturday, the annual 100,000 Poets for Change. 100,000 poets. They're probably not all here at the same time, are they?
Boy, I hope not.
Sponsored by Lost Horse Press and the Bonner County Human Rights Task Force, they team up for the fifth year to present a poetry and music open mic for local writers, musicians, artists, students to express their ideas for positive change during the 100,000 Poets for Change. So join Sandpoint poets and musicians as they connect with artists all over the globe. to express their aspirations for a better world. It's from 1 to 4 p.m. at Evans Brothers Coffee. For more information, you can go to 208-555-4410. So what else is happening, Julie?
Well,
fall fishing coming up?
There will be a little fall fishing coming up, and we won't be discussing that next Tuesday, but possibly the following Tuesday. I've been getting out and doing a little bit of fishing. For those of you who care, it is a great time to be out, so don't leave that off your list of things to do.
Any favorite spots, or can you not tell us?
I would actually get in very big trouble if I gave away the
spots. Tell us your least favorite spots and pretend they were your favorite spots.
There we go. You know what? There's so much great fishing around this area. You can hardly go wrong. Let's say that.
Okay. Well, coming up in weekends through October 22nd, so for about another month, the Hope Islands Cruise. Enjoy a scenic tour around the four islands of Hope and learn the colorful history of the Hope area during this Lake Pendere cruise aboard the Shonda Dess. Tours depart at 4:30 p.m. from Kramer Marina on weekends and some weekdays, so check their schedule out through October 22nd. The tour includes a cruise by Pearl Island, a bald eagle sanctuary, plus enjoy breathtaking scenery and spectacular fall colors. The salon at the Shonda Dess is heated for comfort, and you can get more information on tickets or availability at lakeponderecruises.com.
And that seems like a bit longer cruise than they might do in the summertime, because often they're just out in the main bay around the Long Bridge. So for those of you who would like to see more Lake Pendere, that seems like a great cruise.
Fall is really a spectacular time to be out on the lake and out on our local hiking trails, and it's a good time to be listening to KRFY Morning Show on Tuesdays, as we often feature some of the activities that people can be engaging in or resources that are available to them to find out more about where to go and how to do things safely in the fall.
So true.
Yeah. So we're queued up to do a little bit of Roy Orbison, Oh Pretty Woman. The title of the song is not Pretty Woman, it's Oh Pretty Woman. As we know from our vast research library here at KRFY.org. So we're going to listen to that. It was hit, excuse me, a little frog in my throat. Maybe it was a turtle, but 1964, this went to number one on this day for a 3-week run on the U.S. charts. Oh, pretty.